So, I perhaps underestimated how much of an emotional talk it could be, and how intimidating also. It's been I've given lots of talks over the last few years in lots of different circumstances. So, to some extent, I've become immune to the pressures of having done a talk. It's been a long time since I've felt intimidated like I'm feeling today. Firstly, thank you all for coming. It really is a compelling reason to have an ad hominem promotion to have Professor Jacobs give you an introduction. She has been an amazing dean over several years in the Faculty of Medicine, and has this uncommon and unparalleled ability to introduce one in such a way that the actual speaker gets terribly excited about what he's going to say. So it has been quite a long journey from, as Marion says, I grew up in Woodstock, which is a scant kilometre away, and it's this geographical proximity somewhat belies the distance between Woodstock and a place like this. And I'm incredibly grateful for the grace of God in helping me make the journey over the last kilometre. It's been an interesting year as well. As many of you may have known, I had a bit of a health scare early on in the year, a little bit of a health wobble, in my view, that I've recovered from very well. The people around me have taken a little bit longer to recover from it. And so I had what is called a subarachnoid hemorrhage, which is a brain hemorrhage, which is the bad news and also the irony, of course, given my profession. And the good news was that it was relatively minor. It seemed to be a sporadic, unpredictable event that shouldn't have any implications for the future. And I seem to be relatively well, certainly physically well, and cognitively, hopefully you'll be able to attest at the end of the lecture. But it has an upside. All brain hemorrhages have an upside. I don't know if you knew that. The upside has been, of course, on a serious note, that I've been tremendously honored and humbled by the sheer volume of people that care about me, that have come out of the woodwork, and people that were obviously my immediate family, and Barbara was a tremendous trooper. We had young children, of course. The neurosurgeons, five of whom came with me to the ICU. I don't think the ICU has ever been as intimidated as that before. Through to arbitrary people who are just I knew in passing, but I'd came back to work, and I'd bump into them in the corridor. It's the first time they'd seen me since the hemorrhage, and they just want to give me a hug. And it was just an amazing, humbling, and very honouring experience to be part of such a community that I've really valued. The other upside of the hemorrhage, there's always upsides of everything, was that now whenever I forget names or forget faces or forget birthdays, I just say, oops, you know, sorry, I had a hemorrhage. And it's great because increasingly, kind of working up in the university, one has to go to more and more meetings, and some meetings you really don't want to go to. And sometimes I just honestly, I forget that I'm supposed to go to a meeting, and I say, well, oops, you know, sorry, I had a hemorrhage. And then sometimes when I'm involved in arguing with people and I'm getting tired, I just say, hey, look, give me a break. You know, after all, I've had a hemorrhage. And then when I have to pull the real big guns out, and somebody's really going on and I'm really getting tired, then I really pull out my party piece, that I get a shocked look on my face. I grab my head. I have a pained expression on my face. And they say, what's wrong? I said, oh, I don't know. I've just had a sudden headache. And it works every time. So in the run-up to this lecture, I was chatting to Marion, and as she said, I was at Howard Christie. It was a high school in the 1980s, and I think I underestimated how much of an effect it had on me. And really, it was a formative period in the way that it shaped my thinking about all sorts of things, in particular disadvantage and oppression and just colonialism, and in fact everything that can be associated with being the underdog, I guess. And that spilled over into my medical career as well. So I feel very strongly now that for children, that it should never be determined by the amount of money that a parent makes, the quality of care that your child does or doesn't get. If a child grows up in South Africa, there should be no reason that they get a poorer quality of care here in South Africa than they do in New York and Paris. The third thing was that we work obviously in the state sector and the academic sector, and there should never be an excuse for delivering a poorer quality of care. We have great association with our private colleagues, and they deliver an excellent service, but we in the academic centers are not just a health service for patients who can't afford to pay. Very important that we are that, but we also should be seeking to reach the pinnacle of our profession and in fact deliver highly specialized services that can't be delivered in the private sector simply by taking advantage of the infrastructure that we have, creating the infrastructure and clustering and regionalizing services. And then the fourth thing that it made me realize, and I'll get off my soapbox after this one, but the fourth thing that it made me realize is actually, one doesn't think about it as such, but there's an enormous advantage in disadvantage. And so disadvantage is part of our national discourse, particularly of late. And then there's disadvantage around every corner in South Africa, usually economic. You can't escape the issue of disadvantage. And being from Africa, being from South Africa, there's disadvantage when you compare us to our North American or European colleagues as well. But I think what a lot of people don't realize is that confronted with that disadvantage presents us with challenges and opportunities to develop in ways that people who grew up in an advantaged life often don't have. And if there has been any success that we have had in our unit thus far, and if there will be any success in the future, I think this is pretty much at the root of it. Okay, so let me get started with my mouth is getting dry already. So before I get started, obviously there are people I need to thank and acknowledge. And as Marion said, my mom died when I was a teenager, but unquestionably, she was the one that had the greatest influence over my life, and I think my brother Wesley as well. And then, in the wake of her dying, a close relationship with her siblings, or aunts and uncles, all pulled together to make sure that we had a place to stay well through until the end of my undergraduate year. So I owe them a huge debt of gratitude. And then also to my wife Barbara, who's been amazing. She's been a tremendous support over many years, in particular over these last couple of months with my hemorrhage, and particularly with having young children. Our two daughters, Sarah and Olivia, who are just gorgeous. They're amazing kids. They drive me crazy. I drive them crazy. They know that the job is hardwired into me. It's part of my DNA, but they also know, hopefully, that my world rather revolves around them. It's an enormous privilege to be part of an amazing department, our division of neurosurgery. I think it's the premier division of neurosurgery in the country. It's filled with individuals who are smart, who are hardworking, who are very strong-willed as well, and all risen to the top of their profession and are the best at their subspecialist care. So if I was ever going to have a hemorrhage anyway, and I needed a vascular neurosurgeon, it was going to be in our department, where Alan Taylor and Dave Lefevre could take care of me. Now, this isn't a painting of our department. This is a painting from a French post-impressionist called Paul Gauguin, which looks at the three stages of life, the left being where we come from, the middle being what are we, and the right side being where are we going to. And I thought that's a great platform to think about the history of our department and where the department's going to in the future. And unfortunately, the painting wasn't popular enough to be included in the Goodman Gallery. So they haven't snapped it up. But rather than dwell on that concept, we'll zoom off to the next picture. To Professor de Villiers, who really was the figurehead, the fatherhead of us as a neurosurgical nation here in Cape Town in particular, and spearheaded the development of a very strong department and laid an incredibly strong foundation. Now, just before I tell you about him, I got an email from a friend this afternoon. He said, congratulations on your inaugural, good luck for your lecture. My challenge to you is to use four words in your lecture. One was Goodman, one was Zuma, one was Spear, and one was Nation. Which I've just done, so apparently there's a free meal coming my way. So this is Warwick Peacock. Warwick Peacock started the pediatric neurosurgery unit at Red Cross. before relocating to the US, and they made his reputation on an operation called selective dorsal rhizotomy. So this was in the 80s, and in fact, quite ironically, just a couple of weeks ago, there was this big debate in the House of Commons, the British House of Commons, because dorsal rhizotomy wasn't available to patients on the NHS. So I had all these patients, these British patients, going over to Europe to have this operation that was developed here, when they could actually come to Cape Town and have it for half the price we had started. Professor Peter, I must apologize for the quality of the photograph, but it was the only photograph that I had with him with a tie on. And he's a very formal man, and I think he would forgive me putting up a poor quality picture rather than one without a tie. Professor Peter really is my father in neurosurgery in the department. He gave me my first job. He clearly saw something in me that I didn't recognize at the time, and really set the tone for our department as it is. And that's continued with Graham Fegan, who really was schooled, Jonathan Peter, really with the same philosophy of looking at young people or people in the department and giving them space, giving them opportunity to develop, seeing what they were enthusiastic about and giving them support in that. And I didn't realize how rare that was in a department until I started traveling. And departments in the US, for instance, sometimes you don't get those opportunities. Sometimes you're lucky if you leave the department without a knife sticking in your back. And then there have been many international colleagues that have contributed to us, that we've grown in friendship with, we've grown in terms of our clinical and research aims. And at Red Cross, of course, Red Cross is where it all happens. And Professor Peter, Professor Fegan, we've recently been joined by Dr. Padiachi, who's been training pediatric neurosurgery with us now as a consultant. He's tremendously talented, he's got enthusiasm, he's going to be something big in his own right, I think. Our registrars have been working with us, and then Ursula Rolving, who is a new breed of people that we're having in a department, somebody who comes from a non-clinical background but has become very familiar with the clinical environment, much more so than most neurointensivists that I come across. Worked through a Master's of Neuroscience with us very quickly, and now is doing a PhD in neuroscience and a project on tuberculosis meningitis, which I'll talk about a little bit later. But Red Cross Children's Hospital really is a special institution. It's still the only freestanding pediatric hospital in the country. We manage national referrals from all over the place. We have services that are offered in no other part of the country, and yet it still isn't recognized as a national hospital, and I think that's a tragedy. One of the things that makes this hospital tick are the quality of the nurses. These are two of our sisters in our neurosurgical ward, Manda Apples and Michelle Marie. Honestly, if I didn't know my anatomy better, I would have thought they had an enthusiasm gland that produced happy hormones, because they're incredibly enthusiastic about the job, and it just diffuses through the whole department. This is the ICU. Andrew Argent runs the ICU. We have a very good collaboration with Andrew Argent. We get to do all our neurocritical care work there. They look after the body in a way, again, that can't be matched anywhere else. The Children's Hospital Trust has converted our poky little operating theatres in the past, through a building project like that, into these operating theatres, which really are the state of the art. And I don't say that lightly. We've had so many visitors, some of whom are here. There's someone from San Francisco there. There's someone from Italy there. There's a consistent comment that they all make, that the theatres are better than anything that they have. And for instance, Dacklin Payne works at a private hospital in San Francisco. I've been to the hospital. The hospital theatres look pokey compared to ours. They're wonderful theatres, and I think it really contributes to a wonderful job that we get to do. This is a view from our theatres. We, in between stressful cases, we look out on the mountain and we get an opportunity to look onto upper campus and see what Dr. Price and the rest of the university are getting up to. All right, but we're here to talk about neurosurgery. We're going to talk quite a lot about our research program. But what I wanted to do was start with surgery, because ultimately we in our department, we're surgeons. So that's our primary identity. That's the thing that makes us tick. And in fact, when I came back from my hemorrhage, I was doing ward runs and I was doing clinics and I did a bit of research and I did a bit of administration, but I felt that I was back. And everybody else felt that I was back once I operated for the first time. And that's the thing that really makes us tick. And in fact, of all the compliments that of the few compliments that have been given to me over the years, the one that I treasure most is actually been about my surgical skill rather than my research enterprise. And it just feels honest. It's like manual labor. It's like you're doing something with your hands that potentially can make a difference. And one of the surgical operations that really got me, the surgical approaches that really got me fired up, and again an example of something that Graham had started that was very happy to give to me, even as a registrar, was that of endoscopic neurosurgery. We put a camera in the brain. The brain is these ventricles. There are water spaces in the brain. Water gets produced in the ventricles and it flows out, and sometimes it gets obstructed. And so you go into the ventricles of the brain, and this is why we've always loved it, because it just looks beautiful. This is choroid plexus, almost looks like soft coral. It makes the brain water. This is in part of the brain called the third ventricle. This is the hypothalamus. These are called the mammillary bodies for obvious reasons. And this patient had an obstruction. He needed to make a hole in this membrane to bypass that obstruction, and that's what one does. Make a hole to bypass that obstruction, and you can see as you make the hole, suddenly there's a hydrodynamic change, and now water is pulsating across that hole, and it's bypassing the more distal obstruction. You make the hole a little bit bigger because you're connecting the fluid in those ventricles to fluid in what's called the subarachnoid space. And once we go in, you'll see why it's called the subarachnoid space, because it's filled with these arachnoid-like membranes. This is the brainstem. This is the major basilar artery coming up the face of the brainstem. And you've made that hole. You don't need to do any other kinds of operations to solve the problem of hydrocephalus. So that's what attracted to us. The anatomy is just beautiful. Even if you don't know what you're looking at, you won't know what you're looking at here, but it just looks beautiful. And so this happens to be the brainstem. These are cranial nerves that are coming off the brainstem, running into the base of the skull. And these are the cranial nerves, the nerves that go to your face, the nerves that go to the muscles are swelling, accompanied by their respective nerves. It's just, and that's why we enjoy our job. Okay, but from a research point of view, the first thing that really got to me was the problem of head trauma. Trauma in general in our country is, as you know, a major problem. It's higher, it's 7 or 8 times higher than the global average. And head trauma in the whole body of trauma, of course, is most important because it accounts for about 70 to 75% of the mortality after injury. And the mortality, of course, is just the tip of the iceberg. And the patients who survive may survive with neurological disability, and apart from the impact that it has on their lives, it has a tremendous knock-on effect on their family and disability grants, etc. And one would think that with head trauma, South Africans would be particularly good. So the lay person's view of South African doctors is that they're good at trauma because they see a lot of trauma. But that's not necessarily true. No more true than if you grew up by the seaside that you'd be a good swimmer. It depends, of course, on a concentrated effort in trying to make a difference. And the reality is, when one looked at it objectively and honestly, we were particularly bad, or we as a country were particularly bad at treating head trauma. We weren't on the frontiers of research. At all the major meetings on neurotrauma, there were never South Africans there. There were never Africans there. The leading centers were the centers that, in fact, saw the least amount of trauma. And we weren't publishing at all. And the outcomes in terms of our mortality figures in most of the centers was actually quite bad. So there was no evidence that actually people seeing a lot of trauma, they were particularly good at it. So the burden of injury is massive. These are data given that week from Cape Town. This is data from Cape Town. You'll see, compile their statistics. This is from the MRC, so maybe that's why. So they compiled their statistics slightly differently. They looked at rather injury or trauma, mechanisms of trauma, so it's homicide and road traffic accidents. But when you put them together, the injury is actually, in terms of a burden of disease, this is years of life lost, an index of premature mortality. So the idea being that if you died as a 90-year-old, it would be fundamentally different compared to you dying as a 20-year-old. And injury actually accounts for the largest burden of disease. It's even higher than in Cape Town. It's even higher than HIV. But people don't often think that way. So if you kind of Google HIV in South Africa in the commonest medical search engine, which is called PubMed, you get almost 10,000 hits. So it's a search engine that goes over about 50 or 60 years. If you look at TB in South Africa, you get 3,372. If you look at injury, you get about a quarter of that, which has been published on HIV, despite the fact that, of course, we've been dealing with trauma for the last 50 or 60 years. And if you drill that down to the most important aspect of of trauma, that being head injury, given that it accounts for so much mortality. In that 50 or 60 years, you get 300 articles only from South Africa. Now, if you look at those 300 articles but a little bit more critically, and you check out all the stuff that's actually not really about head trauma research or clinical trauma research, and you exclude the stuff that we've published, in that whole period, you have 45 clinical articles on head trauma research, which for a country that has a trauma burden 7 or 8 times the global average, where your chance of a child being killed by a traumatic event is about 6 or 7 times higher than a similarly aged child in America, from our point of view, that's a tragedy. So why have we got into this situation? One is because you heard from Marion, getting funding for nationally for head trauma research is virtually impossible. Now, all my many failures I will wear as a badge of pride. And the irony is it's easier to get funding internationally for head trauma research than for nationally. And if you look at what they have on their website, you'll look, there's some great things for TB, epidemiology, molecular microbacteriology, a center for molecular and cellular biology. If you look under the crime, violence and injury section, they only got one unit, and that's the safety and peace promotion research unit. Now, of course, prevention is very important, but we've been at preventative strategies for a long time now. It hasn't meaningfully impacted our trauma load, so we need to continue with that by all means. Of course, we need to prevent head injuries. The best head injury is one that's prevented, of course, but for the foreseeable future, for generations to come, we are going to have a major trauma burden, and in particular head trauma burden, and we need to be better at doing it, and we need to be producing not only lots of research, we need to be producing some research. But there's also a problem among clinicians, because there are lots of clinicians who've treated, particularly the older set, who've treated head injury in the past, have become incredibly cynical about the outcomes. And you say, why are they cynical? Well, they don't understand it very well, and they'll also look at the published literature. They'll look at the published literature. Sorry, and they'll look at what our gold standard is. They're called randomized controlled trials. It's a gold standard in clinical science and in the medical literature as well. So you look at the history of randomized controlled trials for head trauma, and every single one of those randomized controlled trials have failed. So they'll say, well, look at that. All your interventions for head trauma are completely useless. They don't work. They only don't work if you don't know what you're looking at. And one of the problems with the randomized controlled trials, they're mostly based in the US, so their career advancements is to get a big NIH-funded trial, do a multi-centered randomized controlled trial. But the imperative of a randomized controlled trial is to have a large enough sample so that you can get a statistically significant effect. So to do that, you've got to lump everyone in. And the problem with head trauma is that there's a huge amount of heterogeneity in that sample that you've just lumped together. So patients are very different. So you may take an intervention, say intervention X. And intervention X may be very useful, but it's useful for about 10 or 15% of that population. And then what you do is, because you want a large sample size, you lump everybody together, and you subject everybody to that intervention, including the 80, 85% of patients who never need that intervention anyway. So what you get at the end of the randomized controlled trial is an averaged effect. So it doesn't mean that the intervention doesn't work for anybody. It means it doesn't work for everybody. And then, of course, the intervention gets thrown out inappropriately. So increasingly, in other disciplines like oncology, there's this recognition of heterogeneity. So this is what's called a landmark publication a little bit earlier on in the year, where they looked at breast cancer tumors, and recognized that there's no one breast cancer. There are probably 7 different genomic types of breast cancer. Now, they all have some common elements, so they're all cancers of the breast, but there are 10 different subtypes. So the future for treating breast cancer is to recognize those subtypes and target the treatment according to the subtype, not just according to whether they're breast tumors or not. And I think increasingly this is an approach that we need in head trauma. And then also the recognition that children and adults are different. Even there's heterogeneity in adults, so everybody would agree, excuse me in this, that between Graham Fegan and Arnold Schwarzenegger, there probably are some subtle differences that one can appreciate. And then, of course, between children are not just small adults. And even within the childhood population, an infant isn't the same as a toddler, isn't the same as an adolescent. So it's challenging, of course. So how do you get through their challenges? Well, you look at the history of head trauma. And the history of head trauma actually makes it very... The history of neurosurgery actually makes it very clear that neurosurgery is the oldest profession. Well, actually, it's the oldest medical profession. So about 7,000 or 8,000 years ago, we have skulls from Egypt and Peru and from France, showing that ancient civilizations used to drill holes in each other's heads. So they used to be called trephines, with the presumption that there were all these bad vapors in the skull, maybe for psychiatric diseases, that were released by a good old hole in the head. And then the Edwin Smith papyrus from Egypt, about 1700 BC, recognized surgery for cranial trauma. Hippocrates recognized that the problem in cranial trauma is the buildup of pressure inside the head, which has led to the foundation of treating head trauma, trying to manage the pressure inside the brain. And then celebrated cases like this case of Phineas Gage, who was a railroad worker who was impaled with a railroad pole, and the pole penetrated his anterior base of skull, went through to the top, damaged both his frontal lobes, but we learned a huge amount about what the frontal lobe does in terms of inhibition and personality. So from those austere beginnings, we have moved on to something that's a lot more complex, and it gets very complex, and I'll ask you to stay with me. I'll try not to make it complicated, and if you dial out, just hang in. We'll come back to something a little bit more interesting. So it may be complex, but the principles are actually quite simple. The principles are these, that there's a primary injury to head trauma, and it's not just head trauma, it's in fact anything that can acutely injure the brain. So it might be meningitis, it might be near drowning, it might be metabolic encephalopathy. There's a primary injury that happens within microseconds. So the moment the head hits the tarmac, there's an amount of force transmitted to the brain, and there are axons or nerve cells in the brain that tear. And you can't do anything about that. It's happened. But what determines outcome is not only primary injury, but what we call secondary injury as well. So secondary injury are the things that are stimulated by the primary injury, biochemical, immunological, and physiological cascades that then go on in a cyclical way to injure the brain further. And then also the brain's defense mechanisms, particularly in those first days, are down. So the brain has these amazing physiological defense mechanisms that may be impaired. So physiological events like a change in blood pressure that you or I sitting here would be able to tolerate can't be tolerated by the brain that has these physiological mechanisms that are down. So the important thing about the secondary injury is that this is our opportunity to make a difference, because you can ameliorate that secondary injury. The difficulty and the challenge to us is this, that we've been very poorly prepared to identify the secondary injury. So most units that you go to, unfortunately, if you've had a severe head injury, you land up in a coma, so you're on a ventilator. Essentially what they do is they put you on a ventilator and really hope for the best. Does the brain heal itself, yes or no? If it does, they're going to do good. If it doesn't, they're going to do badly. And if they consider themselves on the cutting edge, maybe they'll measure the pressure inside the brain. But that's about the most that you'll get. Our approach and the approach of a few centers in the world are different. We look at a whole bunch of parameters, not only pressure monitors, but monitors of oxygen inside the brain, invasive oxygenation, non-invasive oxygenation with near-infrared spectroscopy, cerebral blood flow, tissue cerebral blood flow velocity using a special ultrasound probe, microdialysis that measures metabolism inside the brain. All the details aren't important, but we try to have a much more comprehensive view of what's going on inside the brain. And then we output all of that data to a bedside computer that samples data at 50 hertz and gives us a dynamic view of what's happening between all these variables, blood pressure, intracranial pressure, etc. So one of the first things we learned was we weren't doing a very good job. So we were managing patients according to what's accepted as international guidelines, and despite that, there were about a third of our patients who had brain oxygenation that was at very, very low levels. So these were patients that we thought we were doing a completely perfect job according to our conventional standards, and still a full third of them, there was something going on inside the brain that was damaging the brain that we had absolutely no idea about. So this is the idea of secondary injury. So this is from some of our microdialysis data. Looks complicated, it's not. This is an outline point, so ignore that. This is glycerol, so it's a marker of cellular injury. This is time of year, so there's a little peak and then it settles down. These are inflammatory markers, interleukin 6 and interleukin 8. Starts off high and then the whole process is dampened down, and that's exactly what you'd expect after an initial injury. But look at this patient. Glycerol comes up and it stays up. The inflammatory markers start low, and then after a couple of days they pick up, showing that there's a massive secondary injury in this patient, and when you looked at a brain pressure and oxygenation, everything looked bad. So this was an amazing opportunity to make a difference in somebody that was clearly going to run into trouble. So I'm going to show you very quickly three examples of how people can get things very wrong So people have a stepwise approach all over the world in terms of the current guidelines. There's a stepwise approach to treating pressure in the brain. If this doesn't work, try that. If that doesn't work, try this. And they've got this stepwise approach regardless of what the cause of the brain pressure is. But there are five or six different reasons why brain pressure would go up. So that doesn't make any physiological sense at all. So this is one of our patients. This is brain pressure. Brain pressure is bad. Oxygen and blood flow is good. So pressure's up. Oxygen and blood flow is down. That's not good for the patient. And you see that all the time. As soon as the pressure goes up, very sensitively, the oxygenation and the blood flow to the brain just drops out. And you'll see that time and time again, high brain pressure, low oxygen, low blood flow. See this time and time again. This is the critical threshold over there. This is the critical threshold over here. I see pressure goes up, pressure goes up, pressure goes up. Oxygen comes down, down, and comes down and stays down. And that patient's in a lot of trouble. So everybody has that in their mindset. And then when they're presented with something like this, where brain pressure goes up and brain oxygenation goes down, it confounds their normal way of thinking about pressure. And this is just one example. There are many, many examples that one has to have a complicated way of thinking about pressure and not, of course, do a randomized control trial where you lump everybody together. So that's example number one. Example number two is the problem of managing blood pressure. So you wouldn't know it, but there's a lot of controversy, in particular between these two guys that were figureheads. One in the US, a guy called Michael Rosner, who said you need that higher blood pressure in patients with head trauma. And this guy, Karl-Henrik Nordström from Sweden, saying, no, you need a lower blood pressure. It seems like very basic things, you know, very childish things that they would say. But both of their arguments are based on good physiological evidence, and the brain trauma guidelines were kind of caught between the two. And if you knew anything about the physiology of the brain, if you had a comprehensive infrastructure to monitor what was going on in the brain, and you were treating enough patients, then it would be very obvious that both of them are both right and wrong, depending on the circumstance. And the circumstance is this. So in this patient, he's got what's called impaired autoregulation. Autoregulation is that regulatory method or physiological capacity of your brain to regulate your blood flow and your pressure inside the brain regardless of how your blood pressure goes up and down. So you and me, our blood pressure can go up and down, but our brain remains rock steady. In this patient, of course, it was all passively dependent on what was going on with his blood pressure. So you could push up his blood pressure, but his brain pressure would go up, which would be bad. In this guy, you push up his blood pressure, but his brain pressure, because his the autoregulatory mechanism is intact, his brain pressure goes down. So, of course, it doesn't make sense to lump them all in the same trial. And then one final example. In the old days, in the 1980s, we used to use hyperventilation as a strategy to control pressure inside the brain, so it made a lot of sense. You know, when people hyperventilate, when they have an anxiety attack, you always give them a brown paper bag so they rebreathe their carbon dioxide, then they don't drop their CO2, their carbon dioxide, so low in the body, and they don't become dizzy and pass out. So that's the way you treat a panic attack. But You can also use that in the ICU, because when you reduce the carbon dioxide level in the blood, it has a potent effect on the pressure inside the brain. So that made a lot of sense. So everybody was doing that, and then a randomized controlled trial came along, and it showed that on average, all these patients did badly. So of course they threw hyperventilation out. So let's look at hyperventilation. So here's hyperventilation. You drop the CO2, the brain pressure comes down, which is good if you're only looking at brain pressure, which we were in the old days, and to some extent still in these days, depending on where you are. But the oxygen and the blood flow comes down, which is bad. So for this patient, hyperventilation is a bad thing. Look at this one. Drop the CO2, the pressure comes down, but so does oxygen and blood flow. So that's not a good thing. Look at this one. You do the same thing, you drop the CO2, but in this guy, his oxygen and blood flow goes up. So if you turn that around, what about pushing the carbon dioxide up? Hypoventilation, well, in this guy, his oxygen and blood flow goes down, and in this guy, his oxygen and blood flow goes up. So there's this huge amount of heterogeneity that confounds a simplistic approach to studying it, and has created this situation where people are terribly confused. And unfortunately, when I do give talks, I guess, all over the world, people say, oh, no, but you completely confused us. And the brain's supposed to be amazing, but not amazed. But of course, I grew up in the 1980s, and I was a fan of Star Wars, and Yoda always sprouted wise things, and it is hard to see the various mysteries of the brain. But of course, if you use the right tools and you're looking at it in the right way, just at the right angle, there are some surprising things that you find that may confound your notions of anatomy and physiology. Okay, so we're going to take a break from the brain for the moment and try to get back to it very shortly. But this is a snap quiz that I gave some of my colleagues over the last couple of days. So which is the medical symbol? Left or right? The standard medical symbol. Yeah, so you just confirmed statistics, and I should have done a randomized controlled trial, in fact, because my SNAP survey also suggested that the one on the right is the medical symbol, but there's a very smart individual sitting over here saying the one on the left is the symbol, and you're both right and wrong. The one on the left is actually the medical symbol because it's the rod of Asclepius, or Asclepius in Latin. He was the Greek god of medicine, and that's the rod of Asclepius. The one on the right is a symbol of Hermes, who was in fact the god of the high road and the marketplace, and the patron of commerce and the fat purse, and special protector of the traveling salesmen and thieves. So how did that get up? How did that become a medical symbol? Well, it became a medical symbol through an error, a very basic error, again done in the United States about 100 years ago, 1904. The U.S. Medical Army mistakenly adopted the caduceus, which is that one on the right, the caduceus, which is the symbol of the god of Hermes, the god of the high road and the marketplace, the patron of commerce and the fat purse. They mistakenly took on their symbol as the U.S. Medical Corps. And everybody thought, well, it's the symbol of the U.S. Medical Corps, so therefore it should be right. So there are all these medical organizations all over the world that are using the symbol of the god of commerce as a medical symbol. Now, if you extrapolate that to a South African context, beware of the medical organization that has that as a symbol. Okay, so back to the brain. I'm going to switch gears a little bit from head trauma to something called tuberculosis meningitis. So some of you might know that tuberculosis, it's rampant in South Africa, in Cape Town in particular, and it causes meningitis. It causes lots of things in the brain, but meningitis is the most lethal. And it kills patients or disables patients due to two things. It creates this inflammatory exudate, this inflammatory collection at the base of the brain that either causes hydrocephalus, which is a buildup of brain pressure, quite similar to brain trauma, and because it strangulates the blood vessels at the base of the brain, it causes strokes. And there are lots of mysteries about tuberculosis meningitis. One is how that goes to this in 5 months, despite the patient being on adequate treatment and a TB bug that is sensitive to the medication. There are all sorts of mysteries about the immune system and this recognition that the immune system gets activated and keeps on going despite the fact that you've killed the bugs. And so the very thing that you mount as an immune response to fight the infection sometimes ends up being the thing that kills you. So this is the same video that I showed earlier, the same kind of operation. Then remember that wonderful thin floor that we made a hole in? This is what it looks like in tuberculosis meningitis. It's horrible. The floor is thick, it's inflamed, and even below that floor, that subarachnoid space, is all filled with this horrible exudate that leads to these strokes. One of the things that we've recognized is that brain oxygenation, if you don't treat the pressure, brain oxygenation drops. So this was one of our patients recently. One of the nurses forgot that the ventricular drain that is a let-off of the pressure was clamped. The brain oxygenation just steadily over several hours came back down to very, very low levels. And then when you open the drain, the brain oxygenation rocketed up. And the interesting thing of this case was the pressure levels were pressure levels that we would have considered completely normal. But in a patient on the verge of a stroke, weren't normal. This is something called near-infrared spectroscopy. There are these things that we put on the forehead that try to measure pressure in try to measure oxygen in the frontal lobes. And you can see, even in this person who had completely normal pressure, just simple methods of getting oxygen into the blood, transfusing the patient, giving them enough fluid, getting their blood pressure up, controlling their sodium, shows an improvement in their brain oxygenation from very low levels to very acceptable levels. Basic things that don't need a neurosurgeon. But unless you're looking for these things, all of these conditions end up being a mystery. And they're a mystery, and this was one of our first patients. We did everything right. We had hydrocephalus, the water spaces were high, we put a drain in there, we controlled the pressure, we ventilated the patient, we got his hemoglobin up, corrected his sodium, and then everything was looking perfectly fine. Normal brain oxygenation is above 20. And you can see cruising over here, then suddenly over a period of about 2 or 3 hours, his brain oxygenation precipitously declines with no external evidence of what was going on. So we have absolutely no idea of what was going on in the brain of this child. And unfortunately, we didn't save him. This was a week later. Also, good brain oxygenation suddenly declined. I happened to walk into the ICU at the time. I thought, oh no, this is the exact same situation. Don't know what's going on. We tried everything. We pushed up the oxygenation, pushed up his blood pressure, gave him a transfusion, and this is what happened to him. Shut up, and it came back to normal. And he ended up with no infarction, no stroke. And that was our first indicator that maybe there were things that were going on in the brain that we didn't know about, and B, that there's potentially something you could do about it. And so that's given rise to one of our projects and many that are soon to be started. This is Ursula Rolving's project on tuberculous meningitis, the idea that we don't have any marker, any measure of what's going on in the brain in terms of structural damage or inflammation. So this is something called S100B and glial fibrillary acidic protein neuron specific NLAs. We run them on ELISAs, and we're looking at cytokines of inflammation in the brain, in particular in the CSF or the brain water and the serum, and running them on Luminex. The idea being getting a better picture of what's going on inside the brain and hopefully using that to develop new therapies. Okay, then coming in for the final straight, the last thing I want to tell you about is going back to surgery, in fact. In a space, it's called intraoperative monitoring. It's something that Professor Peter and I started. And again, it wasn't something that was available anywhere in the country. And we thought that was a problem, so we started doing it. It's based on a very simple premise that the whole of your body, sensory and motor, is based on very simple principles of electricity. So you feeling all the complicated sensations that you have, all the complicated maneuvers that you can do with your limbs, is all can be reduced to simple electricity, the principles of current, voltage, and resistance. So if you can reduce them to that, then you can measure them continuously. And that's the whole idea of operating on of somebody with a tumor like this. Nobody wants to operate on a tumor like this. It's right up, it's high up in the neck. It's in this spinal cord. It's a diffuse tumor. Nobody wants to operate on this because your chances of leaving the child or adult paraplegic are very high. And what's worse, when you're in the operating room and you're confronted with a spinal cord and you've got to go through the normal spinal cord, because unfortunately, like the anatomy books, it doesn't come with labels or diagrams and say, that says tumor here, or this is tumor and this is normal tissue. So it's a very small area, it's 2-3 centimeters in diameter, and you've got to find the tumor in there and protect the normal spinal cord. And if you get it wrong, the patient's a quadriplegic on a ventilator. And you've got no indicator of how much damage you're doing until the patient wakes up or doesn't wake up after the operation. So that's the whole idea of intraoperative monitoring. So you can monitor those electrical signals. So we put all sorts of electrodes into the face muscles, and the muscles are swallowing, as well as the arms and the legs to monitor the motor and the sensory pathways. All of that goes to somebody sitting by a laptop to monitor the signals while we're operating. And while we're operating, we can see whether we're doing damage before, hopefully before we've done any permanent damage, or oppositely, the confidence to continue and aggressively do the operation when you know everything's okay. So this is just one very quick example of how we can get it wrong very easily. So this is somebody with a craniocervical junction problem. So this is the area of the bottom of the skull where the brainstem becomes the spinal cord, and you can see that this white stuff is brain water, this gray is the spinal cord, and you can see it's horribly, horribly pinched there. And he was starting to develop weakness in the legs because this is so pinched there. So the operation we need to do is to take a piece of bone off here and to relieve the pressure of it, which in theory is quite simple. The problem is that is critically compressed. So the danger, of course, is that in the operation you may just push it over the edge. And so this is what we started with. These are electrical signals, so we give them a jolt of quite high voltage, usually 200-400 volts, but very, very low current, across the motor strip. And you can pick up that in the arms and the legs. You started perfectly fine. Now, of course, we have to do the operation with him facing down so we can get to the back of the neck. And we did that. Everything was fine. We did the run again. Everything was fine. And then we adjusted his head just slightly so that we could get into a place and do the operation comfortably. And all the signals were gone. So just that slight maneuver of changing his head position, his signals were gone. Now, of course, if we didn't have that monitoring capacity, we would have continued with the operation. And there's a very high risk that he would have landed up quadriplegic. We adjusted that head. All the signals came back. Alright, so where to in the future? Well, there are some surprising and sometimes unpredictable things that happen in one's future. You can never quite predict where you're going to go. But the projects that we got running are microdialysis at the moment. We've got a very exciting project in collaboration with the guys in Sweden looking at the metabolic health of the brain. What's actually happening on a metabolic level? What's happening to the brain in terms of inflammation? And what's happening to the brain in terms of drug recovery? And we've got three honor students that have joined us in this, all of whom are here. And I think it's going to be a very, very exciting project that's going to lead to a lot more things. And this is also another thing, something called cortical spreading depolarization. These are visuals from a colleague of ours in London. These are waves of depolarization in the brain, waves of electrical activity going around in a circular motion around a focus of injury. And as the waves of depolarization come across, they cause all sorts of metabolic havoc. And again, these are things that to date we just absolutely had no idea. There's no data in children, there's no data for meningitis, and maybe that's one of the reasons that I had that patient with tuberculosis meningitis where their brain oxygenation was completely fine, and 2-3 hours it was zero and they stroked. And then finally, the one group that I haven't mentioned, of course, to thank, is all the children and the parents, the fathers and the mothers who brought their children in to us over the many years that we've been there. Graham and I often fondly talk about kids that we remember kind of 8-10 years ago. And it's a privilege. We really do regard it as a privilege to be doing the things that we do. We enjoy our work, but we work hard and long hours and we get grumpy sometimes, but it really is a privilege. And the truth is that we recognize that there, as a parent, there's nothing worse that can happen to you. Absolutely nothing worse that can happen to you than have your child fall ill, potentially with a mortal illness. So whether you're a parent or you've got nieces or nephews, take it from me, there's nothing worse that can happen to you. Now, children are vulnerable at the best of times. And it's at the worst of times that these parents have to bring their child into us. And amidst all the anxiety and anguish, they have to hand over the children to us and have faith in people that they've never met. We regard it as a privilege. We don't take it lightly. And we work very hard. We do everything in our power to be the difference in those children's lives. And most of the time we get it right. And sometimes we don't. And sometimes we can't save them. But regardless, we always count it a privilege to have been a part of that child's life. And it's also a continual reminder for us to go home and appreciate that by the grace of God, we've got children in our lives that are happy and healthy. It's also a constant reminder, of course, that it's only by the grace of God that we are all here today. So thank you for being here today, and thank you for listening. And if there's anyone that missed out in my thanks, I apologize. Please don't feel aggrieved. After all, I had a hemorrhage.